As promised, we're joined by a reporter and, in fact, a storyteller for NFL Media. He is a Hall of Fame voter. He is the author of Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon. He is a judge at the 4th Annual Turf and Surf Barbecue Championship at Del Mar. He is a really good friend of the program. He is Jim Trotter. Jim, what's going on? How are you?
Romy, what's happening, man? How are you?
My man, I'm great, Jim. How about you? How are things?
I got no complaints, man. None at all.
Good. All right, so let me start with Antonio Brown. Jim, he lost his case to be allowed to wear his old helmet. Let me ask you this, Jim. Which part of this drama was less surprising? The fact that he lost that grievance or the fact that he did not retire and leave millions of dollars on the table over it?
The latter. I mean, that's what I found so interesting when the story first came out. And people were like, will Antonio retire? And I'm like, all you ever have to do in the NFL or really professional sports is follow the money. And if you follow the money, you know he was never going to retire, not over a helmet. And in fact, when I believe it was last night on Hard Knocks, you heard him say that he has so many people depending on him and so many people he's responsible for, that was never an issue. So I don't know if it was just the emotion. We know Antonio is an emotional player. I don't know if it was the emotion of what he was dealing with his feet or what, but, you know, the thing that I found so interesting about the case is he's filed a grievance against the league, but that policy was agreed to by both the league and the union, and so at the same time, the league is, or the union is representing him during the grievance, and in my mind, I'm just like, what doesn't add up here? So he never had a leg to stand on in the grievance. We all knew he was going to lose. We knew he wasn't going to retire, so to me, it was always much ado about nothing.
Jim Trotter, my guest. One more thought about that. You tweeted an image of a poster that's in every locker room about the helmet testing results, where teams were required to have that poster up before players returned for off-season workouts. And as you pointed out, only one out of nearly 2,000 players is fighting this particular push for player safety, Antonio Brown. What do you make of that, Jim? Why is he the only one fighting this fight?
Jim, I can't begin to get inside of his head over that. Look, there are players who are not happy about this. Tom Brady, we know. Aaron Rodgers, we know. But they all adhere to the policy. You know, and to me, this is the larger point here is that it's another example of how sometimes you have to protect players against themselves. And I understand that he has a helmet that he's like and that he's been using for over a decade and whatnot. But based on all the information we know about brain trauma and everything else that we're learning, you have to protect these players against themselves. And if you look at what the league has done in terms of enhanced enforcement of rules that are around to protect a player, you know, in terms of his physical being, this isn't surprising, and players are going to have to adjust to that and accept that. And that's why, again, it never made any sense to me that Antonio was fighting this, particularly fighting it so publicly, because I can tell you for a fact, I know the league had been working with him for months, and I'm saying months, trying to get this thing resolved. And so for it to get to the point where literally the league had to tell him, you cannot go on the field with that your old helmet, it wasn't that Antonio left. It was that he was told he could not go on the field if he put on the old helmet or if he did not put on a certified helmet. So, you know, it was disappointing. But in this day and age, and particularly at this time of the year, things get blown up, and that story got blown up.
Jim Trotter is a reporter for NFL Media, a good friend of the program, joining us again. All right, Jim, so there's been a lot of attention, of course, paid to Antonio Brown and the Raiders, but then you've got Andrew Luck, and he's dealing with an injury that appeared to be a calf strain and now might be an ankle injury. I mean, the whole thing to me, Jim, is really strange, kind of bizarre. Stephen Holder, who covers the team, tweeted the other day, quote, "Guys, look, I've read a lot of speculation and Googled a lot of medical terms in the past couple of hours regarding Andrew Luck, but there's a reason I'm not talking about it on Twitter, because I don't know bleep. Like all the rest of us, will chime in when I know more," end quote. What do you make of that and the situation with Luck?
I thought that was great reporting, first of all, by Stephen. I think too often in this business, we got to have a hot take. You know, we got to have an opinion. And sometimes we simply don't know. And I don't think there's any shame in saying, I don't know. Look, the Colts and Andrew Luck are being very, I don't want to say secretive, but obviously they are taking care of him in terms of keeping his information private about his health. I don't know what to make of the story. All I can make of it is that Andrew Luck went through a serious injury with his shoulder. I think it sort of how do I say this? It taught him about the mortality of sports, and so I think he's being very careful with this injury. There's no reason to rush it. We get information from Jim Irsay saying that, you know, now it's something about a bone. So none of us really knows what it is, and I'd be foolish to sit here and speculate on what it is. I think Andrew Luck will return to the field whenever he feels that he is healthy enough to do so.
Talking to Jim Trotter. All right, Jim, you've got a piece. I agree with that, by the way. I mean, the injury seems to be moving, right? Or but we don't know. Is it a bone? Is it a muscle? Is it an ankle? Is it a strain? We don't know. Now, you've got a piece on NFL.com about Bears All-Pro safety Eddie Jackson III. He is not a household name yet, but that's going to change shortly, I think. You went back to Florida. What was that experience like with him?
You know, the thing I love to do in the off season is get with these players and let them tell their story, whatever it may be. Every player has a testimony about who he is and where he comes from and the things that have impacted him. And so whenever I get those opportunities, I really relish them. And with Eddie Jackson, you're right. People are going to know his name. Players already know his name. He was all pro last year in the second year. It's a fourth round pick out of Alabama, in part because he broke his leg his senior year and there were concerns about an injury history. But he is just a tremendous player. No defensive player is better at converting from defense to offense after a takeaway. And he's got five defensive touchdowns over the last 2 years, which is two more than anyone else in the league. And that's his mentality, is to just be a playmaker. And so we go back to Florida. And the thing that was interesting to me about it, you know, he pulls up to his house in the South Florida neighborhood where the median home price is like $90,000+. And he's in a $300,000 Rolls Royce, which isn't his, which was loaned to him when he came to town. He has a friend who owns a car dealership, exotic car dealership. And so it was just interesting that people were looking at the car like, you know, it really doesn't belong here. But yet Eddie felt so comfortable because that's where he's from. And he said, everybody tells me that, you know, I should stop coming back home. I should stay away from the neighborhood. But he goes, that's just not me. You know, that's not who I am. And I'm not going to go Hollywood. And so, you know, long story short, his story is that it's never too late to do the right thing. And as a teenager, he was arrested for a second time on burglary charges. His life appeared to be heading in the wrong direction. His mother felt like she had failed him. And when he heard that story from his aunt, he just went in and put his arms around his mother and said, "You didn't fail me or my brother. It was us. You know, it was our choices. And I'm not going to let you down." And he turned his life around. And now he's set, you know, next year's the first year that the Bears can renegotiate his contract, and you can anticipate that he will be, if not the highest paid safety in the league, one of the highest paid safeties.
Jim Trotter joining us. Jim, you condensed that, so let me just say as a follow, he took you to a spot and said, quote, "This is where I got arrested," right in the middle of the street. He took you to a particular house and said, "This is the house that we got arrested trying to rob." And then you mentioned a phone call from his aunt. What about that phone call from his aunt? What did she say, and what changed for him after that?
She told him that his mom felt like she had failed him, and you know, she's in the back room crying, and it hurt him to his heart, because you have to understand, his brother DeMar Dorsey, he was one of the top safeties in Florida and ended up not being able to get a scholarship because he had gotten into some legal troubles. And so, you know, right there they were hoping that Eddie would learn from that, and he really didn't. In some ways, he felt overshadowed by his brother, and so he didn't want to play football. He had even quit it after his freshman year. Didn't play as a sophomore. Then he gets arrested again. And his junior year, he gets kicked out of his high school. His grades are so bad that he can't play his junior year. And so what he does is he goes to the neighborhood high school then, and he starts taking online courses to improve his grades and to get eligible. And he starts thinking about college, and he goes out and plays football as a senior and winds up being one of the top players in the country and gets a scholarship to Alabama. So, you know, again, when you talk to Eddie, he said, "Look, I had so many people who wanted to basically give up on me when I was young, who wanted to throw me away." He said, "I even had someone in middle school, one of the employees who told him he should just quit school." And thankfully for him, he had some people around him who would put their arms around him and keep, as one of his teachers said to me, loving on him. until he got to a point that the light went off and he realized that there was a better way to go.
So, Jim, one more thought about that. As you mentioned, he went to Alabama, and he wanted to get away from Florida a little bit. He's a four-year starter, but did not get drafted until the fourth round. I understand teams are going to miss on players in the draft every single year, but how do you explain a guy going where he did in the draft and becoming an all-pro safety as quickly as he has?
You know, he's extremely talented, but you have to remember, as a freshman, he tore an ACL, so there was that injury. Then, you know, his last year at Alabama, he breaks a leg, and so he doesn't play half the year. And so some GMs I talked to, I asked that question after, and they said, look, we like the kid, but we were just concerned about his injury history, and so we backed away from him. And obviously, it was interesting, when he didn't get drafted on the first 2 days, he basically turned off the draft and said, I'm not watching it the third day. And so he's literally in his bedroom sleep when the phone rings. And by the time he gets to the phone and he checks the message, the Bears calling. And so he calls the Bears back and he gets voicemail. And then they call him back and tell him he's been drafted. And instead of being excited, he's sort of angry. And he walks into the living room and tells his mom, almost matter-of-factly, you know, I've been drafted by the Bears. And then he goes out back, and again, he's pacing around because he's angry again. He lasts until the fourth round, and his dad tells him, it's all right, baby boy, just make them all pay. And that's what he's doing. And if you talk to him, there is that chip on his shoulder. And I know it's such a cliche, but he feels that way, that he wants to show all these teams that they made a mistake by letting him last until the fourth round.
Jim Trotter, back on the program, good friend of the show. Jim, a couple of thoughts before you go. That's a really good piece. You've got another excellent piece on the lack of diversity in NFL head coaching and also in the front office. What do you make of how the latest cycle of hirings played out in that regard?
You know, Jim, the thing that's most interesting to me is that when people start to lose hope that there's fairness in the process, that becomes an issue. And I'm walking through the mall in Indianapolis during the scouting combine, and I see a handful of African-American coaches that I know, and they call me over. And the next thing I know, that they're just sort of lamenting the hiring process in the NFL, where the last 2 years of the 15 head coaching openings, only two were filled by a person of color, and one of them was fired after one season when he was put into a really bad situation in Arizona. And so they're just, you know, they're asking what can be done to level this playing field, to give more opportunities to men of color. And sadly, they couldn't, or they wouldn't speak out publicly in terms of putting their names on and whatnot, because they feared that there might be a backlash from teams about it. And what was interesting is that one of the people who finally said, you know what, I'll speak out on it, was Daryl Drake, the Pittsburgh Steelers wide receiver coach who passed away, you know, the last few days. And that's the type of man that Daryl Drake was. He said, look, I'm 62 years old. My window is closed on me being a head coach, but I need to speak out for these younger men and say that this isn't right and the guys are frustrated and they don't know what to do, because the narrative that was being put out, or that is being put out, is that there simply aren't enough African-American coaches on the offensive side of the ball who either call plays or work with quarterbacks. Well, just last June, the NFL and the Black College Football Hall of Fame held a summit down in Atlanta where they brought in minority coaches on the offensive side of the ball from the college and the professional ranks. And you could see in that room, not only were there enough candidates, but they're qualified candidates. And I'll point this out, Jim. If the narrative is that they want young, offensive-minded coaches, you know, to come in and be head coaches in the NFL, well, the offensive coordinators in the BCS National Championship game last year were both African-American. One of them coached Deshaun Watson and now has Trevor Lawrence, who's projected to be a number one quarterback pick in the NFL. And the other one coached Tua, who is expected to be potentially a number one pick in the NFL. And I'm not saying that they had to get jobs, but what I am saying is that if the two of them were white, would they not have at least have been interviewed to understand what their philosophies are and how they approach coaching quarterbacks and coaching offensive play calling? And that's part of the problem here. You know, as these minority coaches see it, is that they're not even being considered for some of these jobs, even when they have the qualifications.
So all of that said, Jim, and I think that's fair. I think that's very fair what you say. All of that said, when this comes up, the league is frequently referenced, but how much of this is about individual team owners and CEOs?
It's all about owners, Jim. I mean, bottom line, Tony Dungy said to me that the NFL needs to have a course where they bring in the owners and teach them how to hire people. and start with the basics. Because as Tony Dungy said, it is not a supply problem, it is a demand problem. And if when you get in these interviews and you come out and you say that these candidates were impressive during their interview, then what exactly is stopping them from getting opportunities here? And that's a question that only the people who are doing the hiring can do.
Jim Trotter, my guest. All right, Jim, Sunday, before you go, Sunday, you are serving as a judge at the 4th Annual Turf and Surf Barbecue Championship at Del Mar. I'm not looking for you to give away your process or your secrets as a judge, but what are you looking for when you judge?
Bro, yeah, come on, man. It comes down to one thing for me. It's taste, man. It's taste. So, you know, is it tender? Is it moist? Is it, you know, does it have flavor? All those things. And look, I'm not in any way saying I'm qualified to be a judge. They bring in what they call celebrities. I don't consider myself a celebrity, but they bring in people who they consider to be celebrity judges and let us do this. And everyone who knows me knows I love tri-tip. And so I'm fortunate enough that Sean Walshiff, from Cali Comfort Barbecue is allowing me to come in and judge for a second straight year. So I say to everybody, if you love barbecue, come on out. It's always a fun time, and it's great food.
I love it. He's a reporter, a storyteller for NFL Media. He is a Hall of Fame voter, also the author of Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon, and the judge, a judge at the 4th Annual Turf and Surf Barbecue Championship at Del Mar, Jim Trotter. My guest, Jim, appreciate you so much, man. Thanks.
Tell me anytime, man. Love being on.
Love having you on, Jim. Appreciate the friendship. Jim Trotter has done the show. He's done all of our shows for years. He is one of the very best to ever do it.